coming out. So I'm going to be speaking about a continuous formulation of the loop quantum gravity phase space. This is the title of the paper that we've recently put on the archive with Laurent and Mark Geyer. Basically, this paper is trying to relate loop quantum gravity to general relativity in some strict sense. So some outstanding questions that we have in loop quantum gravity and spin foams would be, what is the strict relationship between a spin network phase space and the continuous geometries in general relativity? Also, at the microscopic level, we have two different interpretations of what this geometry might be. In spin foams, we imagine that space would be made of piecewise flat cells that are somehow glued together, where loop quantum gravity, on the other hand, views space as made sort of a singular metric, so that the electric field is concentrated only on the edges of an embedded graph. So these different views suggest two different forms of volume operators. There's a volume operator recently developed by Eugenio, where you try and calculate the volume of a region as if it were a flat polyhedron. And there's a traditional volume operator using some combination of what you get from all the different edges that puncture a surface. Another question we would have is that if we can calculate or can obtain a dynamical theory of quantum gravity, how will we be able to check if it agrees with general relativity? So although loop quantum gravity aims to directly quantize general relativity, there's actually a non-trivial gap between the theories. Loop quantum gravity uses graphs to discretize the continuous space of GR and at the same time develops a quantum theory upon this. The key idea we want to use is that you can disentangle these two steps. So we can begin with general relativity, first perform a discretization to obtain a discrete phase space, and quantizing this discrete phase space would yield the Hilbert spaces of loop quantum gravity. So to help address the questions in the previous slide, we would like some intermediate theory, which you might call loop classical gravity, to bridge loop quantum gravity with GR. So in this talk, I'm going to begin by reviewing the continuous variables for general relativity in terms of the connection and electric field variables. Then I'll also review the discrete holonomy flux variables on a spin network. We'll then employ a flatness constraint on the continuous phase space to try and concretely relate it to the discrete phase space. Then we'll explore which types of continuous geometries can be described by the holonomy flux data in the discrete phase space. And we'll close by summarizing and looking at the implications for further developing loop quantum gravity. So the continuous phase space is parameterized by a connection A and an electric field E. A is given by the Levi-Civita connection, and we add to it an extrinsic curvature term multiplied by the Amirti parameter. And these variables have the canonical Poisson bracket given by this equation. Now, for convenience, we're going to work with the two form obtained from the electric field like so. And we'll also sum over a basis of the generators of SU2, these tau i's, to write E and A with no indices at all. Now, this above Poisson bracket is defined by this symplectic potential, which will be important later on. In the continuous theory, we have three constraints. We have a scalar constraint, diffeomorphism constraint, and the Gauss constraint. And the scalar constraint generates dynamics, while the diffeomorphism and Gauss constraints enforce invariance under diffeos and SU2 rotations. We'll consider in particular the Gauss constraint, written in terms of form language like this. And this constraint generates finite SU2 rotations given by these equations for some G that's an element of the SU2 group. So how are we going to impose the Gauss constraint within this continuous phase space? This is something called symplectic reduction. So we can first define a constrained space by imposing that the continuous variables satisfy the Gauss constraint on X in sigma, where sigma is the 3 geometry. Now, we also want that fields related by gauge transformations should represent the same physical point. So we divide out the action of the Gauss constraint. So we first constrain the fields and divide out by the action. And we can equivalently write this using a double quotient notation. So this is just the continuous field with a double quotient by the Gauss constraint. Now, the situation in loop quantum gravity is rather different than for continuous GR. Loop quantum gravity uses spin network Hilbert spaces, which are associated to graphs. Now, a graph is just a collection of edges with an orientation that meet at their endpoints, where we have vertices. Now, the continuous Hilbert space is obtained in a union of all these graphs, so we have to use a direct sum of all possible graphs. And any one particular Hilbert space corresponds to a truncation of the theory. Now, one thing that is important in this talk is that each H gamma can be developed from the quantization of a classical phase space, which we call P sub gamma, with the nonscript P. Now, this P sub gamma is defined as follows. First, to each edge, we assign a holonomy in the SU2 group and the flux in the SU2 algebra, and this gives a phase space on each edge of the cotangent bundle of SU2. And there are some consistency relations we need to define on the phase space such that under orientation reversal of an edge, we obtain these relations. The phase space over the entire graph is given by the direct product over all edges in the graph. And here we have P gamma at the bottom. Now, the Poisson algebra for these variables are given by these equations. One thing that's interesting to notice is that the fluxes do not commute. If you were to think of fluxes as being purely intrinsic data, you find this puzzling. We'll touch on this later on again. And this symplectic structure is defined by the following symplectic potential. And we'll keep this in mind for later on. Now, we also want to look at the Gauss constraint in this phase space. First, I'll just note that the graph is not necessarily embedded in any manifold, so it's manifestly Diffeo invariant at this stage. And the Gauss constraint in this phase space is written as a sum over all the fluxes that have an endpoint at a single vertice. So we write each vertex by summing over all of the fluxes. The finite gauge transformations generated by this constraint are given by these equations. The holonomy transforms at the SE, which stands for the starting point of the edge, and TE is the terminal point of the edge. And notice that we have a rotation on the fluxes given by group elements at the starting point. So the reduced phase space with respect to the Gauss constraint is obtained by taking the double quotient of the Gauss constraint at each vertex in the graph gamma. So far, we have the GR is written in terms of some infinite dimensional continuous phase space, while loop gravity uses some union of finite dimensional discrete phase spaces. And for practical purposes, we often consider the phase space associated to just a single graph. Our goal is to try and find an isomorphism between the discrete phase space and some reduced form of the continuous phase space. So we're going to try and prove this isomorphism by defining a one-to-one map between the phase spaces and then showing that it's invertible. Now, in order to define the discrete data from the continuous data, we embed a graph within sigma. And now we have to choose a dual graph. And this graph is dual in the sense, we choose a dual cellular decomposition, I should say. The cellular decomposition is dual such that each vertex of the graph is inside each cell of the cellular decomposition. And each edge of the graph intersects a single face of the cell. Now, the intersection of all the faces around the vertices define a dual graph gamma consisting of edges, dual edges. Now, with this construction, we can begin to define the discrete data from the continuous. The holonomies are given by the path-ordered integrals of the connection along each edge. And here we do something different than the traditional formulation. Usually the flux is defined as just the integral of the electric field to form over a face. But notice that this doesn't give us the transformation property we want under SU2 rotations. So we instead use this definition, which transforms as we want. And with this definition, we also have an explanation of why the fluxes don't commute, because they now contain information about both the extrinsic data in the holonomies and in the intrinsic data of this E2 form. I also have to explain what this holonomy is. So this holonomy is giving the parallel transport from the starting point of the edge E along the edge to the face, and then along the face to the point of integration. So at this stage, it seems like a rather complicated construction and that it will be difficult to deal with. But we're going to introduce something that will make this easier to handle. So we've established a one-to-one map now between the continuous fields and the discrete data. This map depends on an embedding of gamma and gamma star, a face that is dual to each edge, so we can choose where the face is. It just has to be bounded by the edges in gamma star. Oh, gamma star is the dual graph defined by the union of all the dual faces. And we also have this system of paths to define for each flux, which is a real stick in the side. So also notice that different choices here are going to lead to different mappings. So we'll get different holonomies and fluxes depending on which choices we make here. So given the discrete data, we're not able to determine the continuous fields without knowing what these paths are, pi, or where the face is, for example. So in this situation, how are we going to be able to invert the map? So the key to inverting this map is using a partially flat connection. We impose flatness, so f of a is 0 within each cell, but allow curvature on gamma star, so that's the boundary of each face, by smearing a flatness constraint with some parameter phi, which is 0 on gamma star. So we enforce this flatness everywhere except on gamma star. Now this flatness constraint doesn't have any effect at all in the connection, but it does something very interesting to the electric field. And in this, these types of gauge transformations have a big change in what happens to the electric field. Now let's define the holonomies and fluxes from this continuous data that satisfies the constraints. So the holonomy is given by this equation, a group element at the start and at the end. In flat space, it doesn't depend on the path you take. So A is, and we also use this A that defined as a holonomy as well, a path-ordered integral of A going from X to V. So it's sort of defined backwards. We start at X and go to V. Now the flux, since the holonomies are independent, is also the same for any choice of paths. And notice also that due to the Gauss law, it's independent of the choice of face. So if you integrate over some bounded region with the Gauss law, and there's no source inside the region, you get zero total flux if you integrate the flux over the face. And looking at the equations that result from this statement, we can integrate over the Gauss law, which is 0. This becomes the total derivative of this expression. And then using Stokes' theorem, this is just the difference in the fluxes. So we see that one flux is the same as the other, regardless of where you choose the face, as long as they're both bounded by gamma star. Now, we want to relate the continuous and discrete data using the flatness and Gauss constraints. We enforce SU2 invariance everywhere except the vertices, so we use a similar smearing where now alpha is 0 and all the vertexes in gamma. And the reason we do this is that we can show with the partially flat connection that violations of the Gauss law occurred just at the vertexes in gamma. And we want to be able to relate to the discrete phase space that doesn't necessarily have SU2 invariance gauged out of it. So we can relate this continuous phase space using the flatness constraint and this Gauss constraint to a non-gauge invariant discrete phase space. So we're going to see that the continuous phase space with these constraints imposed is a continuous analog of the discrete phase space. And we can, of course, also consider the Gauss constraint acting at the vertices, and we find a similar relation for the completely gauge invariant continuous phase space with the gauge invariant discrete phase space. Now let us look more closely at the continuous variables in the reduced phase space. So the solution of the flatness in Gauss. The solution of the flatness and Gauss constraints are written locally, like so, in terms of these group elements. And the electric field is written in terms of these group elements with a two-form XV that is closed outside of the vertex. This solution extends throughout sigma by demanding a continuity across phases. The holonomies and fluxes. So these continuity relations are the same as the ones introduced earlier for demanding a consistency on the discrete phase space. Okay.
So I'm not sure I understand. So there's continuous solution, are there distributions? Are they singular or?
No, these define locally what the connection is everywhere. You can get the curvature will end up being distributional, but A itself is defined like this locally everywhere. And as for E, we'll see what happens with E, because there's a large class of gauge transformations that acts on E. Okay? So in terms of these solutions, the holonomies and fluxes are written as before. And for the holonomy and the flux is now just the integral of this two-form over the phase. Now, in terms of A and XV, what do the gauge transformations do? Well, the gauge transformations generate a transformation on this holonomy like so, where G0 is some element of SU2 that is fixed to the identity at the vertices. Because remember, we're not enforcing the Gauss constraint there. And we have this more non-trivial transformation on the two-form XV. And notice that these transformations leave the holonomy and flux independent. So these group elements simply cancel out, leaving the holonomy independent. And we use Stokes' theorem to change this term into an integral over the boundary. And phi is 0 in gamma star, which is the boundary of a phase. So we have a map from the continuous reduced phase space to the discrete phase space that is 1-to-1 and also invariant under the action of these constraints. Because of this, this implies that a single spin network corresponds to an equivalence class of continuous geometries. And this equivalence class, members of this equivalence class are related by gauge transformations generated by these constraints. And because we have this highly non-trivial gauge transformation that acts on the electric field, there's a wide range of metrics that can result from this. And a similar map exists between the fully SU2 invariant phase spaces. So now we're going to try and invert this map. Using this result that the Gauss law is concentrated at the vertices and also the compatibility across faces, we can actually show that the symplectic potentials are equivalent with the direct calculation. And now since symplectic potentials are invertible by definition, this means that the map is invertible, and we therefore have the isomorphism that we were seeking from the reduced continuous phase space to the discrete phase space. And a similar argument holds again for the fully SU2 invariant phase space. Now, as I've mentioned a couple of times, this flatness constraint presents a wealth of choices for the electric field, which corresponds, of course, to a metric. Now, a choice of gauge is going the reverse direction. So if we start with discrete data, what type of continuous fields can we define? And we'll call this a choice of gauge. Now, we want a good gauge choice to be diffeomorphism covariant, so that if we act on the manifold with the diffeomorphism prior to the map, this should be the same as first doing the map and then acting with the diffeomorphism. And we have found two gauge choices that satisfy this condition. And remarkably, they are the spin foam geometry, composed of piecewise flat cells with a flat metric within each cell, and the loop quantum gravity geometry, which is singular just on the graph and zero everywhere else. And we may even conjecture that these may be the only choices, but we certainly don't have a proof. So I'll just outline very sketchily how we can show that these two gauge choices exist. Using distributional forms, we can use discrete data to construct a singular electric field, as in the loop quantum gravity interpretation. And the electric field is then given by this form. So we simply sum over all of the edges. We know what these holonomies are because we can solve for the connection. And we can then define what these path holonomies are. And of course, it doesn't depend on what the actual path is. It just goes from the start of the edge to the point of integration. We have the flux. And then we have this delta function, which concentrates the electric field on each edge. So this delta function, if I integrate over E in terms of some coordinate y, and this is a distribution value 2-1 form, so a 2 form in x and a 1 form in y, that gives me something that if I choose a face that punctures, that is punctured by this edge at one point, I'm going to get a contribution at the puncture by integrating over this delta function sub E. Okay? And for the spin foam gauge, we use an existence proof. And we can show that there's always a gauge. If you have some E that is not flat, there's always a gauge transformation that can take you to a flat E within each cell. And the spin foam gauge, of course, reminds us of regigeometries. But notice that in the spin foam gauge, the cells aren't necessarily polyhedra. So you can have generally curved edges on the cell, and the faces can generally be curved. Only in the case when these edges and faces can be made to be flat does this correspond to a regigeometry. We can see that there's more information in the spin foam gauge than the regigeometry. If the edges are flat, we have access to only one component of the extrinsic curvature, whereas if the edge is allowed to vary, we have access to the full extrinsic curvature. So this shows the spin foam gauge has more, has more information in it than a regigeometry. So we have considered the discrete holonomy flux phase space associated to a graph, and the quantization of this phase space yields a spin network Hilbert space. We reduce the continuous phase space using flatness and Gauss constraints. And the reduced continuous phase space is isomorphic to the discrete phase space. Now this relates the semi-classical kinematics of loop quantum gravity to GR in some precise manner. So we have that the discrete phase space corresponds to a class of gauge equivalent geometries. And since the discrete phase space quantized gives us a loop quantum gravity Hilbert space, we can view the discrete phase space as a semi-classical limit of LQG. So in this way, we're bridging loop quantum gravity with general relativity through using this discrete phase space. So at the beginning, I spoke of a few questions that we had, and we have now answered them. So what is the precise relationship between spin networks and spatial geometries? Well, now we know that a spin network corresponds to some large equivalence class of gauge equivalent spatial geometries. So which view is correct, the piecewise flat view of spin foams or the polymer geometry of loop quantum gravity? So we've shown that both of these are in fact correct because they're both defined by a spin network and they are just different gauge equivalent descriptions of the same data. So which volume operator would you use? Well, if you're going to do some calculations, you can choose which gauge you want to work with. If you're going to choose the spin foam gauge, you should work with the volume operator that calculates the volume of polyhedra. If you want to choose the LQG gauge, you should choose the LQG operator. So in a sense, we're able now to also relate these very different looking volume operators and show that they're just volume operators acting on different gauge choices. Now, if we can obtain a dynamical theory of quantum gravity, how would we check if it's consistent with GR? So one way we could do this is to have some discrete form of the dynamics written in terms of holonomies and fluxes. So if we evolve a coherent state according to loop quantum gravity, we can check if this agrees with our discrete dynamics. And we should then try and relate the discrete dynamics to general relativity. And this is the bridge from a dynamical theory to GR. So this brings forth a big question. Is it possible to express the classical dynamics in terms of holonomies and fluxes given a union of all the phase spaces associated to all graphs? Now, this is an important question that we should try and answer. If the answer is yes, then we'll have some discrete theory, and the quantization of it will be reduced to quantization of finite dimensional systems. So we have all these individual phase spaces, and we just have to quantize each one separately. And I'm sure there's more non-trivial steps that would be there, but somehow working in this union, we can try and develop a quantum theory. The dynamics may end up being graph changing, so we could have to work on how to go from one phase space to another, but this should be a good way to explore dynamics in loop quantum gravity. If the answer is no, this is a strong negative result if you could somehow show that it cannot be done. Because if you cannot write classical gravity in terms of holonomies and fluxes, then how can LQG work? How could the quantum theory of a corresponding classical theory that doesn't work be a consistent quantum theory? So I actually anticipated a lot more interruptions. So that's my last slide. I expect there may be questions about the last slide, or I can go on to give you some more detailed proof about perhaps the gauge choices or the symplectomorphism, if you like.
And since you've been quite efficient, we have quite a lot of time for questions. So, yes, Lee?
Yeah, I'm confused on two parts of what your intention. So let me ask it in the reverse order of my confusion. The construction you gave is based on a single graph.
Uh-huh.
But the whole point in the dynamics of loop quantum gravity is graph changing. It's not a question whether it is or not. It is graph changing.
Okay.
And therefore, the dynamics takes you out of any one of these individual spaces.
Yeah.
There is already... So I don't understand there's a set of interesting results. It gives an interesting new perspective on states, etc. But I'm very confused about why at the last slide here you make these very provocative comments, because these are not the issues that I understand as being the troublesome issues with quantum gravity. Which leads me to my second question, is that, I mean, there is a derivation of loop quantum gravity is the quantization of general relativity already. And so implicitly you have some, if you're doing all of this, you have some critique. There's something you don't like about the standing derivation. So I don't know, I'm confused about what it is.
Okay, so your first question, you mentioned something that, if I understand, that the dynamics of quantum gravity isn't the troublesome part. That must not be what you meant.
Is what?
The dynamics of quantum gravity is the most troublesome part, as far as I can tell.
No, it is, but it is graph changing. And if every time you have a dynamical move generated either in a spin foam amplitude or by the Hamiltonian constraint, which changes the graph, it takes you out of the Hilbert space
into another Hilbert
that you define. So it seems. So I don't understand where that leaves us. The whole point of the usual loop quantum gravity Hilbert space is that it contains all possible graphs.
And I'm talking about
the Hamiltonian constraint acts within the Hilbert space. It doesn't take you out of one Hilbert space into another Hilbert space.
And I'm also considering all possible phase spaces. I'm not planning to work just one phase space. I want to somehow work in the union of all these phase spaces.
But again, I mean, excuse me for being whatever traditional, but traditionally one has a classical theory, it has a single phase space. Well, one applies some rules of quantization to it, and one gets a single Hilbert space. So if you imagine that your classical theory is constructed from a whole bunch of disconnected phase spaces, you're doing something profoundly
But the Hilbert space is constructed in the direct sum of a whole bunch of disconnected Hilbert spaces. So I think taking a union of all these phase spaces is the classical analog of the loop quantum gravity Hilbert space. No?
We have cylindrical consistency, so not just the union.
Pardon me?
We have cylindrical consistency. Which means
right, so you have to be able to map a continuous function consistently onto some graph and then transfer from one phase space to another phase space with that function. So that's something that we can
also... In your philosophy, basically your statement that it can be reduced to quantization of finite dimensional systems.
Systems.
Yes.
So,
but this would mean that you don't take the LQG, standard LQG Hilbert space, because the standard LQG Hilbert space is not finite dimensional.
I'm talking about each individual Hilbert space is finite dimensional, and we sum over them. I'm talking about working on each phase space individually, and then somehow taking the union of them to develop the theory, which was then an infinite dimensional Hilbert space. But since it separates into these separate phase spaces, we can work on each one individually. And maybe it's a good way to attack the problem.
By the union, do you mean the direct sum?
No, I think there's a consistency condition. You have this big phase space, infinite dimensional, and this H gamma. There's a cylindrical consistency. The cylindrical consistency is that there's a nesting of this phase space in some sense, which are nested by this. By this gauge condition, and then if the gauge group is bigger than the other ones, then there's an embedding of each phase space.
It's not a union, it's a kind of projective.
No. Yes, there's a projective limit there of phase. So
projective
the question is asking here is just whether at the classical level you can formulate the dynamic of GR in terms of this projective limit of phase space. And the intuition is that it seems extremely difficult to to have a formulation, let's say, of the infinitesimal generator, the Hamiltonian generator, maybe for the finite time evolution parameters. But at least there's a natural question that you can ask at the classical level, which is the exact analog of the question that people ask at the quantum level. And because it's classical, there's only one answer. Either you can do it in terms of this projective limit of free space, or you cannot.
And Lee asked another question, my critique of the loop quantum gravity quantization. So dynamics in loop quantum gravity is difficult. We should, in attacking these problems, it's often useful to try and divide the problems and attack less of them at the same time. We see that many of the complications arise already in this discrete classical picture, without having to worry about ambiguities that arise from quantization. So if we study just this discrete classical system, it is perhaps an easier problem than trying to solve all of loop quantum gravity, and we can then develop the quantum theory one step at a time instead of doing the discretization and quantization all at once.
So let me understand that, because, these truncations of the classical theory of general relativity is, even if it doesn't map directly onto Reggie calculus, it's something like Reggie calculus, introduce a set of piecewise flat solutions of the Einstein equations defined by a certain set of conditions plus triangulation. And you get instead of the Einstein equation, some discrete family of difference equations.
Mm-hmm.
And so that holds true for Reggie Cogger. So you might take the point of view that the route to a quantum theory of gravity is make a discretization of the classical theory, quantize that discretization of the classical theory, and then study a limit of the discretization being taken away in the quantum theory, which is a strategy of some approaches to Reggie Cogger. But is that your strategy?
My strategy is to first try and find the dynamics on the discrete phase space without worrying about quantization. So just solve all the problems that arise from the discrete phase space and the fact that we have to somehow worry about cylindrical consistency in going between the phase space.
Right, but your overall strategy is, rather than deal with the Einstein equations, construct a series of discrete approximations to the Einstein equations.
Yes.
Quantize those, and then your hope is to arrive at the true quantum theory of general relativity by taking a limit in which the discretization is taken away.
That's not exactly what he showed. What he showed is the relationship of with the continuum. So the thing is that you have this discrete structure, and usually they are thought as being some approximation. What it showed here is that these discrete structures have an exact continuum interpretation. So they are not discrete. They are showing that each of these discrete structures, you can understand them as some very precise equivalence class of continuous structure. So it's very different from the fact that you discretize these things. You know exactly what these things are from the point of view of the continuum.
But there are
not an approximation. They are just,
In the phase space. So I'm confused. Why are they not an approximation? In the phase space, a set of piecewise flat.
The piecewise flat is, is a choice of gauge. So once you choose a gauge, you choose a particular discrimination. But the relationship with the continuum is that every
discrete structure. But this gauge is with respect to F.
Yes,
which is not the constraint of general relativity.
No, it's not. So the thing is that this discrete structure represents some particular equivalence class of continuum geometry.
But with respect to the constraint F equal to zero, which doesn't give you
an equivalence class. So the equivalence class is defined as.
No, but with respect to this condition, with respect to F equal to zero.
Yeah,
so you chose F equal to zero, which is much stronger than gravity.
Yeah, but that's what these things represent. They represent a sub. They represent a They represent a particular class of continuous geometry, and this particular class is not defined by GR.
But you're not claiming that given a smooth or piecewise smooth whatever solution to the Einstein equations, there is a gauge transformation which lands it in one of your discrete classes.
No, in fact, and then the question, once you have this continuum interpretation, suppose you look at one of these continuum geometry in this class, then you evolve it with the Einstein equation. You want to know in which, what is going to be the next step? Is it going to end up into something that is also describable as a particular gauge equivalent class or not? And that's this question, and that's a very precise question. You see, you can use, once you interpret this discrete data, not as discrete, but as continuum data, then you can evolve this continuum data with the continuum Einstein equation, and you can see what is the consistency of your discrete kind of filter that you impose with the Einstein equation. And then you can ask whether, there's a way to put the two together or not.
But isn't it unlikely?
Well,
if
that's,
you start with
but
two different,
maybe.
Your equivalence classes are quite big, so if you start with two different geometries,
But here, there's no assumption about
very different geometries.
I'm not saying it's going to be like. That's why you say yes or no. If it it's either work or it doesn't work, it may be likely that it doesn't work.
This philosophy, also, that is the because you don't want to allow for continuum.
Well, the continuum
alternative philosophy is still to take basically to do what.
No. The continuum limit is in there. It's this projective limit.
Yeah, because you want to basically map exactly the continuum theory on a discrete series. This I find unlikely. Personally, I find it unlikely to work.
But there is an alternative, which is
to take the continuum limit of your discrete approximation.
I think here we are at the same level. Maybe there's a continuum.
So
it's the same level as the quantum gravity. You have the full Hilbert space, the one which is this kind of, you know, projective limit of all this phase space. And then you want to know what happens if you, which we do in quantum gravity, what happens if you take from, you start from initial data, which are in this particular subclass, and then you evolve in time. Can you describe the evolution in time also in terms of an infinite collection of some graph? Or, you know, is there a way you can make sense of this graph changing operation at the classical level?
You evolve in time with the general lapse or with the lapse, which is also piecewise constant?
With a general one, it doesn't matter because the data are continuous. There's no piecewise linear. You see, the piecewise linear thing is a gauge choice. You don't have the data. What he shows is that the data is a continuum.
But the data, when the data is piecewise flat.
No, not necessarily.
Piecewise
no.
A flat.
No, the data is that each discrete data corresponds to an equivalence class of geometry. So they correspond to an infinite number of possible metrics. On this infinite, you know, on this orbit, one of these data is piecewise flat, one of these data is singular, and then there's all possible sources in between. So
it's still a very small subset of the solution of the initial data found in generality.
It is a subset. So the question is that suppose you start within this subset, which is what we do in new quantum gravity. We start with a state based on gamma, and then you evolve with H. You know, do you stay within? So the usual hypothesis of new quantum gravity is that if you do infinitesimal evolution of a data which is in this subset, then it's going to stay within a neighboring subset labeled by a certain number of graphs which are related by certain moves, right? This is an hypothesis that you can now check. So if you start with exactly initial data in that subset, by infinitesimal evolution, do you stay in a similar subset or not? And that's a very precise. So Bianca is saying it's unlikely, which might be true, which is the answer no, or it's likely, which is the answer yes.
But I don't think if the answer is no, that doesn't mean that loop quantum gravity cannot work.
Not being able to do it is not a proof that it won't work. By no, I mean if you could somehow prove that it can't work, not just that you try and you fail. You know, trying and not being able to do it doesn't prove it won't work. I don't know if such a proof would exist, but
is it possible to express the dynamics of gravity in terms of classical dynamics, in terms of velocities and fluxes? Yes, it is. It was done a long time ago. That's the Ashtekar constraints expressed as a certain limit of regulated constraints based on velocities and fluxes. It was done in 1986, 1988. The answer is yes. You can represent all the three different constraints of quantum gravity plus the Hamiltonian if you have asymptotic conditions in terms of certain limits of expressions written down in terms of velocities and fluxes.
Then the question is this limit consistent with these truncations that we work with?
That's a different question.
But if not, then it means that this limit cannot be expressed as a graph changing operator. Or, you know, that doesn't need to be there. In order to define limit, you need topology. So here, in some sense, you know, naturally there's a natural topology, which is this projective limit type of topology. And then when you're thinking about limits, you're thinking about another limit, which is this continuum limit, where you have some kind of regulator, and you know, and then they might be consistent or not. So
So this is a new strategy to ask that question, whether consistent dynamics arises from quantizing the regulated versions of the constraints and then trying to study the homogeneous the regulated.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Is there a way to
in the Thomas Thiemann version, the answer is that it seems like there's not a consistent, there's not an interesting form of quantum dynamics that emerges. So that's been the big open question.
Mm-hmm. And the main point is that these questions are mostly classical.
That's the novel
part. The difficult part of the question is mostly a classical question, more than a quantum question. or at least you can formulate all these questions at the classical level first, and we don't know yet the answers to all these at the classical level.
And the fact that you reduce your initial conditions to this specific class, equivalence class of manifold, is that a worry that you might miss some good geometries?
Maybe, but this is what LQG is about. I think it's the same. You have to think this is what LQG is proposing. LQG is proposing that you can study the quantization of quantum gravity by introducing a certain truncation which are labeled by these graphs. And the way I think about that is that it's the same way that when people propose to study quantum field theory, using a certain truncation, using the number of particles. Right? Any physical state is never a finite number of particle states. But we study quantum field theory by using this truncation. And then somehow, so LQG is making the assumption that you could make sense of quantum gravity by using this truncation. And this truncation is in terms of initial data that are not very unlike the coherent states, like a black hole, but in the same way that in physics, the real physical states of the electric field is not that finite time, right? It's a coherent state superposition. But we still do study this finite time, physics in this finite time to get answered. And then, so,
but then in this case, there would be a map, no? That would correlate quantum state to the finite. You take the number of particles large, and there is a map kind of a basis, right?
Between the
quantum state and
what I mean is that it's an analogy. I'm saying that the number of particles for me is analog to the choice of graph, the number of nodes of the graph. In quantum field theory, once you fix the number of particles, you have a finite dimensional Hilbert space, and you work with that. And then you describe the dynamics by giving the amplitudes between two that change the number of initial and finite. So in spin form, we imagine that we have these truncated states in boundary graphs, and then the amplitude might be something we give by giving all these specific amplitudes. But these truncated states are not the one which represent any physical configuration. They are just truncation. But in V theory, you consider that if you know the answer for all n, then you're good. You know the answer. So LQG proposed this truncation. The big question is whether this truncation is somehow compatible with GR dynamics. Right? Is there a way to use this truncation to make sense of GR dynamics? And that's not clear, even in the classical.
Would you?
See, something interesting here that is, I understand, that if you consider the metric in a region that contains only links but no node, the question is the metric gauge invariant quantity? The answer is no, right? Metric is not gauge invariant.
Undo the flatness and Gauss constraint.
In this problem.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, true.
So isn't this a classical version of the statement that you cannot ask what is the quantum geometry in quantum gravity, what is the quantum geometry in a region that doesn't contain nodes?
Mm-hmm.
You can find an area if there's no node. So does that contradict what you're saying? Mm-hmm. So, what do you
then I want to ask, can you define the classical level an area, for a surface which is intersected just by a gink?
You would need the... It depends which... No, it would depend which gauge you use.
This symmetry generated by F equals 0.
Pardon me?
You have a symmetry generated by F equals 0.
So
So I'm asking if you can build a quantity that is invariant with these transformations and is associated to a surface.
The fluxes are invariant. And, yeah, if you take the flux as your area, then that is invariant.
But the area is not.
Yeah. So the area has a direction. So the area would, in fact, change under these transformations.
So, but you know, that is really I think the main difficulty will be to show that actually these equivalence classes will map to something related. Because if you have f equal to zero inside these cells, it maps you to very different fluxes.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, you can produce a huge
f equals
huge
zero maps to different electric fields, but always the same flux.
No, f equal to zero does translation in the flux values.
No, the flux was invariant under the gauge transformations generated.
No, not f equal to zero.
The curvature of A.
I think it means you mean x of E. I think there's a confusion about what you're talking about.
The E field. I mean, you have a continuum E field.
Yes.
And the continuum formulation.
Yes.
So basically, you have basically the E field inside your cells.
Mm-hmm.
And on that, you impose basically the constraints that the curvature F equal to zero.
Yes. And that generates some large charge.
And you define basically equivalence classes with that.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, this in principle, you can produce inside one cell an arbitrary huge E field configuration.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, why should I believe that if I try to evolve that with a continuum Einstein equation, that this has something to do if I start with a E field configuration which is zero?
Well, if you think that's a problem, I would say that's a problem for loop quantum gravity as well.
I mean, I see these would be two very different initial data, which should be,
the flux through the
very
bases
singular
invariant.
In very different directions.
No, but I think that when you...
That's the whole point, is that this is really what this distruncation is about, and you have to reconsider that.
This is a result. It's not
what I don't understand is the motivation for F equal to zero. I mean, this is not an LQG standard framework.
That's what allows you to do the isomorphism. That's
I
how you can relate.
But
that's
no,
the motivation.
I mean,
it's not
really compatible with the standard LQG.
Oh, no, it should be compatible. You can take the gauge where E is always zero inside the cell.
Yeah, but then then you have to discuss the limit of consistency. Because the standard, interpretation is that you don't really know what is inside the cell.
What do you mean? So the standard interpretation was that E is singular. The standard interpretation related to G is that, you know, E vanish outside the edge. Here we show you can have this interpretation, or we show in here we say, well, like you don't know, and we say exactly how you don't know. That is, there's a precise gauge equivalence.
I wouldn't see F equal to zero as part of the
You
can try to reverse the argument. Instead of showing that there's a relation between the two, you can start with a classical theory, with a finite number of degrees of freedom, that is a topological theory, F equals zero everywhere, except on these defects. And then this is a classical theory, this is not general relativity, it's a classical theory, finite number of degrees of freedom. And then the first question that you can ask is, how can I describe it at the classical level in terms of phase space? You find exactly this space.
Sure, but that is being straightforward about this being a different theory, which is not general relativity.
Yeah, you are stating it in
which you can then conjecture that it provides a nested set of approximations to general relativity for its curvature slowly varying, etc. On the size of the cells or something like that. And that I understand.
But this is what we have in LQG. When we work with a graph, when you use a spin network graph, this is a state which is in a, and you know, when you're picking a truncation. And then when you act, you ask the question, what is the action of the Hamiltonian engineering on this set of graph? You're working on the truncation. That's what we do, and that's why we think it's, that's why everything is finite, because we make we regulate things by finite dimension limits.
But still, then there's this alternative viewpoint, which would be basically be trivial to answer, which is that you take limits, that you see equity as an equity.
But you can take a limit here. You can also take a limit, which is this pi gamma. When you take the pi gamma, where gamma goes to infinity, you just recover the thing because...
But taking the limit in the sense which Lee mentioned, like seeing it as an approximation, and you take the limit afterwards.
You can do that if you want, but here you have
then
more.
This would not rule out LPG. Because, I mean, then you have to study the limit and look what happens.
But we don't study the limit. The question is whether... question is whether you can define the action of H on the state gamma. And that is, let's say, that's the question. Right. Can you define the action of the Hamiltonian operator on the spin network states, yes or no? And if you can do that at the quantum level, then there's a classical analytical state. This is the goal. Either you can define H gamma or you cannot. So, and the AQG make the assumption that you can define, make sense of H at K1 gamma.
Or to put it a different way, is because you can define it. There are definitions in the literature which are very finite because they're graph changing but to a small set of new graphs. Mm-hmm. And you can ask whether any such definition has a classical, as a quantum theory, defines a quantum theory which has a classical limit which captures the physics of classical general relativity. Mm-hmm. And very well may be that the answer is no, mm-hmm. which my understanding, and there's a kind of irony here, because my understanding is that that's why most of us work on the path integral formulation of
quantum theory. Yeah, so then you can ask, okay, so that's the first question, and I think this one is going to be no. Then you can ask, is there a notion of evolution operator mm-hmm. for which, you know, U, like exponential of H, acting on gamma, that you can define? Right. Mm-hmm. Which is the spin formula, which is going to be harder. So the first one, I think, is the classical, but you can really nail it down and improve that. So the second one, you know, actually there's an analogous classical question that's going to be harder to address. So yeah, spin form is the, you know, let's say LQG and spin form are both, you know, there's both a classical version. You know, the statement would be now, suppose I take this kind of equivalence class of initial data, and then I do a finite time evolution, exponential of nh, with an arbitrary lapse. Can I describe this evolution of exponential of nh in terms of a map that maps the special continuous data in terms of infinite collections of other types of discrete data?
But there aren't infinite arrays. As soon as you take the exponential, you're saying between any in and out state, even if they differ just by, say, one edge, the propagation of the projection operator, which has that in to the out state, has an infinite number of graphs in between. That is a sum over an infinite number of histories in which there's an arbitrarily complex foam happening between those two, mm-hmm. between the in state and the out state.
But then you can ask the question, I mean, in principle, technically, given this particular subset of initial data, I evolve it with a particular lapse for a finite number of time, and then I restrict it to another particular set. Do I find none or one or you know? And then we can scan it, or do I always have to go to the limit, which might be the case? But you see,
there's
second one is harder to even. You know, can you describe the finite dynamics of GR in terms of collections of canonical transformation on this finite dimensional phase space? Essentially, that's the spin for my hypothesis. But you can do that. And if you can do that at the quantum level, you can do that at the classical level. So I would say the spin for my hypothesis would be the statement, well, okay, dynamic of GR can be expressed as if you give me two graphs, there's a kind of, for any two graphs, there's kind of a canonical transformation, you know, that tells me how you go from one to another, or a generalized form. There should be some classical stuff.
Mm-hmm.
if it can be done at the quantum level, then there is a classical statement that it survives. That's the whole philosophy. And once you get down to a classical statement, then the classical statement is either true or not. It cannot be, you know, ambiguous.
But the classical statement may refer to a notion of coherent states that is different than the ones you just talked about in the quantum gravity that involves the superposition of an infinite number of graphs.
Maybe
you only reach the classical limit if you have a superposition of an infinite.
Yeah, maybe. But then that's no longer, maybe that's the Hanoverian, but then that's no longer spin form. That is, you know, for me, the hypothesis is that you could formulate the dynamics by putting boundary states which are.
It's not the spin form. What you mean by spin form is spin form with a fixed history.
With
a fixed triangulation.
No, not fixed triangulation, with a fixed boundary. So as long as I restrict the initial state to be a given graph and the final state to be a given graph, and I'm just saying spin form, you know, we imagine that it's possible to give the full quantum gravity amplitude in that basis.
But with a hydrogen atom, with a perturbed hydrogen atom, it is possible to give, you know, the dynamics in the basis of energy and angular momentum eigenstates. But it's very difficult to reconstruct the classical trajectory of an electron in the classical limit of that basis. And so the loop quantum gravity
because same thing, the number operator is just tells you that you have the phase space on the equivalence class. So there's classical symmetry when you compute the symmetry.
There is not a classical, if I say I want to evolve from an n equals 3 to an n equals 1 state of the hydrogen atom, there is a well-defined quantum amplitude to do that, if I specify the states. There is not a classical limit of that description.
There is. That's the...
I'm confused. What's the classical?
You have two truncated phase space. Maybe that's another discussion.
But the
thing is that n equal 1, what you're doing is that you're same thing. You're taking equivalence class of initial data. That's really what you're doing.
But there's no point in phase space or a subset of points in phase space corresponding to the ground state of the hydrogen atom. I'm saying something very simple. It might be that we're in a basis which is very appropriate for quantum mechanical, for quantum dynamics and small scale dynamics, and to get to
I just don't believe that any quantum statement has a cat. Sometimes it requires more work, and I'm just saying that these states n equal 0, they correspond to equivalent class of initial data. That's what they correspond to. And then when you take this amplitude between n equals 0 and n equal 1, what you're talking about is an overlap between the n equal 3, the whole mean in time, and the n equal 1 equivalence class. And then you're measuring the intersection area of these two things. And, you know, this is, I don't know, this, you know, it's, you're computing the symplectic volume intersection area of these two orbits. So I can I can formulate this amplitude in terms of purely, I can formulate the semi-classical limit of this amplitude purely in terms of classical dynamics. Always. It might not be the most natural thing you would do. Why would you consider this? But as I said, you know, this amplitude, I would do that.
Okay.
You have the initial state of equivalence class, final states of equivalence class, initial data. Then we evolve the first one equivalent class, which creates a cylinder. And then you look at the overlap with the other, and you compute the symplectic area, and that's the log of the amplitude. I mean, why would you?
It's not what we usually think of when we talk about the classic picture of an electron.
No, okay, but that's what I'm saying is that there's a classical picture of the quantum truncation. That's
it. I understand.
You see, we do a truncation.
No,
this truncation is motivated by quantum consideration, but it doesn't mean that it doesn't have a classical picture. The classical picture is kind of clumsy, I admit, if not, but it has a very precise classical description.
No, I think it's clear what you have.
Okay.
Well, may I suggest we follow the discussion a bit later,
yeah,
privately, and thank Jonathan again.